Good afternoon and welcome to On the Docket. I'm your host, Patricia Salkin, Dean of Toro Law Center in Central Islip. And every Sunday at this time, we talk about current legal issues and how they affect you. Today, on the docket, we're talking about a recent technology case called Riley versus California and what cell phone users should be aware of. This case was a landmark United States Supreme Court case that was decided a few short weeks ago. To help put this recent case into context, we have Michelle Zacharin. Michelle is a 1995 graduate of Toro Law Center and is now a professor at Toro Law, where she teaches cyber law and cybercrime. She's admitted to the bars of New York and Connecticut. Professor Zacharin spent 7 years in practice before joining the Law Center, first as an administrator and now as a faculty member. She's previously joined us on the air to discuss cybercrime, and we're happy to have her here again. Welcome back to the show, Michelle.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
So thanks. So just tell us what are the facts in the Riley case and what was going on?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so this case actually encompassed two cases that came up for review by the Supreme Court. And the Riley part is the facts of that was that the arrestee was stopped by the police for driving with an expired registration. After that, the police realized that his license had also been suspended. So the car was impounded. And then the defendant was arrested for possession of a concealed weapon and loaded firearms and things like that that were found in the hood of his car. So the police officer searched the defendant incident to arrest and found items that were associated with a street gang. And they seized a telephone, his cell phone, that was on him in his pocket. And by his own admission, it was what we call a smartphone, which is capable of, you know, like everyone has today, a smartphone that's capable of basically all different types of internet access and storage capacity, a broad range of features. The police officer searched the phone and found information and certain words and initials that linked him, what the police officer believed, to be part of a gang. And it was like slang used for that gang that the police officer had seen before. And then so he looked on the phone for further information to see if there was any more links to this gang. And he did find pictures of the defendant with guns and videos of him and standing in front of a car that was a suspected car involved in a shooting previously. So he ended up ultimately being charged with connection to that shooting for attempted murder, among other things. And there was a belief that he was associated with these gangs, and that carries an even stronger sentence. He was ultimately convicted of that. And then the other case that was along with it is United States versus Worry, where it was just routine surveillance that was going on, and they observed allegedly the defendant allegedly making a drug sale from a car, and the car was taken to the police station. Well, the person was taken to the police station, sorry, and they seized what we call a flip phone. It wasn't a smartphone. It was just a phone that you flip open and has limited capability as compared to a smartphone, and the phone was ringing often at the police station, and the words that were accompanying the telephone ring were the words "my house," and it kept ringing and kept ringing. And the police officers, after it stopped ringing, opened the phone and saw a picture of a woman and a baby as the wallpaper of the phone. And what they did was they pressed the phone to the menu button, and then they pressed another button to actually see the call log and get the number. And they got the number of that "my house" number. They did a quick internet search, found the address, went to look at that building. At that building, they saw this defendant's name on the mailbox. They also saw, when they looked in the window, a woman who resembled the same woman from that wallpaper on the phone. They secured the apartment, got a warrant for a search, went back in and seized grams of crack cocaine and other drugs and other drug paraphernalia and guns and ammunition and things like that. And he was charged with distribution of drugs along with other things. So those were the two cases. One was dealing with a smartphone. One was dealing with a less sophisticated phone, more like a flip phone. But the Supreme Court wanted to hear this for the issue of whether the police officers can search a cell phone incident to arrest, because normally they can search certain things incident to an arrest, and whether a cell phone was allowed. So that was the importance of the case.
So what did the Supreme Court decide?
Unanimously, as it would have it, the Supreme Court unanimously, which is not often does that happen, decided that a cell phone is actually not allowed to be searched incident to arrest. And so that it's landmark because we really didn't have guidance until now as to how to treat cell phones when we find them. Police officers can obtain a lot of information from a cell phone that would give them information they may need in the course of their investigation. So incident to arrest, normally they can search and whatever they find can be used against the defendant. But here we've learned that incident to arrest, we can't just search the cell phone. They actually have to wait. They cannot right then and there search that cell phone anymore.
So typically when somebody's being arrested, there's the rule that if something is in plain view, then the police officers can observe that and that can be used. So, for example, if you had a notepad and you had things written down on the notepad and there was no cover on it, that's in plain view. You know, maybe if you had a notebook, I'm not sure if you could open up the notebook or not. Now you have a data that is stored digitally and the court says, even though you know that it's there and that it has information on it, maybe the same that's in a notepad or the same that's in a notebook, because it's digital, it cannot be viewed as something that is in plain view.
That's exactly right, actually. If the phone case had something on it, or if the phone screen that was observed as the phone was picked up had something already on it, that may be different. But to go in the cell phone and do a search, even if it's just a touch of a finger, to tap it, that's considered a search, and police can't do that. The court stated that the term cell phone, even according to the court, was misleading. It's not really a phone. It's more than just a phone. It sounds like, oh, it's just a telephone. But the way they're made today and the amount of storage capacity today is just too intrusive to search without a warrant. So that's really the bottom line, that it's not that these items, like a cell phone, is not searchable. It is. But the police officers have to go through the proper process of obtaining that search warrant first before they can just go in and search it. So right. Anything that's apparently visible may be okay, but certainly they'd have to just secure it beforehand. And they can even search the phone to make sure it's not used as a weapon, meaning a physical examination of what the phone looks like. So if they want to make sure that there's no razor blade hidden between the cell phone and the cell phone case, which is an example the court actually used, they can still do that. That's just to make sure it can't be used as a weapon against, you know, the officers, or to make sure the officer's safety is priority. But they would have to wait for the warrant for that.
Right. So the cell phone, just to be clear, the cell phones are not off limits completely from the police ever accessing the data that's on the phone. It's just that they have to wait for the search warrant in order to be able to access the phone.
That's right. That's right. The court noted that once the cell phone is secured safely, the data on it poses no harm to the police officers. That's how the court worded it. So since there's no risk for officer safety or anything like that, that it just needs to be placed somewhere secured so that we can go through the proper procedures of the Fourth Amendment and make sure that a warrant is given.
So let me play devil's advocate for a
minute.
So we're concerned about officer safety. The courts are always concerned about officer safety. How do you know if from the minute that you're pulled over, by the time the law enforcement runs the plates check and comes out to the car to talk to you, that the minute you get pulled over, what if you send a message to somebody else saying, I've been pulled over, come help?
That's a great question. Okay, so the court actually addresses that. And, if there is a situation where the police believe that their life may be in danger, or that there is some kind of circumstance where they would be maybe communicating with someone else to come help, come get me, you know, bring guns, bring, you know, help me, I'm being arrested, that would be considered an exigent circumstance, which is a separate exception from this incident to arrest. That's just another exception to the warrant requirement, and that would be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. That certainly could
happen.
So
officer might have to say that he or she saw the individual on the phone,
right,
and be concerned.
And that hasn't been played out and tested yet, but the court alluded to the fact that, yes, if there was a risk of the officer's safety somehow, that would be an exigent, that could be considered an exigent circumstance, and that would be a different, that would be okay to search just to see the call log maybe and what happens with that, but still not, I don't believe, for the full search. I think the full search might still need the warrant, but certainly you'd be able to start the search if there were exigent circumstances, just like anything, just like, and then if it led to other things, that's, of course, a whole other story.
Well, we still have a lot more to talk about with digital data, cell phones being pulled over by law enforcement, and what other kinds of electronic data you might have on your person or in your vehicle. So I want to thank Michelle Zacharin for being with us, and I want to ask listeners to please stay with us, because coming up, we're going to hear more about these very interesting developing issues. You're listening to On the Docket with Torah Law Dean Patricia Salkin on Long Island News 103.9. Welcome back to On the Docket. We're still joined by Larry Raifel and Tom Schweitzer, professors of law at Torah Law Center, and we're continuing our discussion on religion and the law. So, Professor Schweitzer, can you tell us exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court decided in the Greece versus Galloway case?
Well, in essence, they upheld the precedent, Marsh against Chambers from 1983, and held it applied to this case. And the fact they interestingly rejected a gloss on the the Allegheny County case. It's rather complicated, but which has suggested that the prayers in Marsh against Chambers were constitutional because they were non-sectarian. And Judge Calabresi, the federal appellate court judge from the Second Circuit, had said you can't really monitor a prayer. I mean, the whole idea of non-denominational prayer is a problematic one, and I think it's a pretty sound point that judges shouldn't get into the job of parsing prayers. So they held that if you want to permit prayer, you can't really monitor whether it is sectarian or not, although, of course, propriety would require otherwise. But they have held it based on precedent in what I regard as a very disappointing decision, which failed to address a lot of the other issues lurking in the background.
Well, so, Professor Raifel, for me personally, it always gets my attention when the U.S. Supreme Court reverses a well-respected circuit court judge. And so I paid particular attention because they were overturning Judge Calabresi's decision. What do you think about the opinion in this case?
Well, of course, Judge Calabresi is one of the great judges in America, and he's very liberal, and he's very smart. So it doesn't surprise me that Justice Kennedy decided to go another way. Here's the problem. Here's the problem with, if you talk, you know, there's a difference of opinion against among people who are well intentioned about legislative prayer in the United States Congress and in state houses. Somebody giving up and giving a quick prayer while a bunch of legislators are milling around getting ready to start. Okay, that's one. In a town meeting like this one, this woman, Susan Galloway, wanted to bring something to the board's attention. So she was sitting in the hall, and they start with a prayer. And the person said, please rise, bow your heads. People are making the sign of the cross. And at the end they would say, let us all say amen. It was very participatory, or you might say it was very coercive, because Susan Galloway would have to then right after that come up and say, I'd like to have a dog barking thing, or a stop sign here, or outlaw beer or something. You know, somebody said, well, if you could leave the room during the prayer. Well, you can't leave the room. People would say, why are you leaving the room? And so I think there's a difference, and I understand the Supreme Court saying, we don't want to be in the business of editing prayers. However, the court should have said, there's a difference between legislative prayer and town boards where the population is present. That's the difference in this case, and the court didn't go that way. That's why I'm disappointed.
Yes.
So you think? Yes. So you think, in addition to being coercive, were they? Was the fact that prayer mentioning a specific person and asking people to participate? Was that also making people feel uncomfortable and maybe...
Well, Justice Calabresi really disliked the way the prayers were going, and he said his quote was, there's a steady drumbeat of Christian prayer. But, I didn't like the fact that some of the language at the town board was not generic. It was pretty evangelical, let's say. But to me, the worst part is the participatory part. Please rise. Please bow your heads. If that's not establishment of religion, I just don't know what is.
Professor Schweitzer, what do you think?
Absolutely, what Larry says is true. It's elementary that any public prayer in a public setting and meeting like this cannot draft those in present to subscribe to this. At the most, you're permitting someone to express his or her religious views to which you're not required to subscribe. And in the Lee against Weissman case, 1992, one reason for outlawing prayer at graduation was that people were expected to stand and show respect. You can't dragoon them to show that they're subscribe to religious beliefs, which they don't subscribe to.
Tom, I wondered what you thought about in the dissent. The dissent talks about the fact that since Lemon v. Kurtzman in 1971, the Supreme Court has always used the three-part test from that case. Why do you think the Supreme Court majority ignored their historical precedent in Lemon v. Kurtzman?
Well, they have played fast and loose with that, and something like six justices have criticized the Lemon test over the years, and there's the endorsement test of Justice O'Connor and the coercion test of Justice Kennedy. And interestingly, Judge Calabresi took three different approaches, and kind of melded them together. But there was confusion. Incidentally, a brief filed by members of Congress decried the chaos of Establishment Clause jurisprudence, and they were attacking. And of course, that's a common for people on both sides. But Justice Kagan, I think, made a good contrast between legislative prayer, where the legislators, as you pointed out, are milling around and maybe not even paying attention on the one hand, and then a town meeting where people come in and seek relief from these people, and they might create a negative impression if they don't show, take part in the prayer of that person, the town council member's religion. So that's totally an inappropriate form of pressure.
So let me ask you this. If we have to keep getting into the discussion of what are the words and what are the actions of people when it comes to prayer, does religious prayer belong at government meetings?
Well, I'm sure Tom has a better opinion on this than I do, but I'm concerned that this opinion really opens the door. Marsh v. Chambers was always about the historical nature of prayer at legislative sessions in America. I'm okay with that. Some people aren't, but I'm okay with that because you're only talking to a bunch of legislators that don't pay attention anyway. If we're going to start school boards and the fire district boards and town boards and county boards where people are present, where petitioners are present, people who have business in front of are present, and we're going to start having theological, ecumenical prayer, then I think that I can't imagine that this particular Supreme Court is going to overturn any of that based on what they said in Greece v. Galloway.
I might point out that, as Larry knows, in 1983 in Marsh against Chambers, Justice Brennan wrote a very eloquent dissent. And he said, if you gave this problem to the average law school student who studied constitutional law, they'd say, of course it's unconstitutional. And one of the weaknesses of that decision by the court in 1983 was they just upheld the practice based on what was true in 1789. And,
right.
It really is out of sync with the whole trend of First Amendment law, Establishment Clause law.
And, well, except, and the court sort of went out of their way to say, we've had legislative prayer for the history of our country. I'm looking for the quote, a tolerable acknowledgement of beliefs widely held. It's a wonderful phrase, whether it's true. But it's sort of a no harm, no foul. But this is much different.
So one of my regrets is there's a whole bunch of other cases from the South, the Fourth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, and a lot of animosity. One circuit said, you can have prayer as long as it's non-denominational. Another circuit said, you can't. You have to give people the freedom to make their own religious references. And So this has increased animosity and disagreement along religious lines, which is very regrettable. That's one thing the Establishment Clause was intended to avoid.
So you are both constitutional law scholars, and Tom, you spend a lot of time on the First Amendment. What advice do you have for there are 110 units of local government here in Suffolk and Nassau counties? What should we do when we want to have a prayer at the start of a government meeting? Do we have to constantly rotate denominations? Does it matter what is said? Is the government responsible for what somebody says from a different church or religion?
I personally care less about the content of the prayer than who's in the room. I think that people feel that that you need to go back to remind legislative boards to go back to the original idea that it's to enhance the gravity of the board meeting, not to proclaim liberty, not to proclaim religion to the people who are in the room.
Yes. My proposal is sort of a secular type of prayer. And, you know, Justice O'Connor said it solemnizes things. I don't know about that concept. But I think that you should recommend, don't make any religious references, but the council members should start by saying, we acknowledge we have a very solemn duty here. You have placed your interests in our hands. And when we vote for something, it can affect your lives and fortunes, and we are very cognizant of that duty, and we take it very seriously, and we solemnly promise to act as fairly and dispassionately and in a considered manner. So it would be, you know, something that was solemnized without any reference to any kind of religious belief.
All right. Well, clearly these are important issues and issues that I think get many people going in terms of whether or not any kind of prayer that has any kind of religious overtones belong in a government meeting. Unfortunately, that wraps it up for us here on the docket. Professor Larry Raffel and Tom Schweitzer, I want to thank you again for joining us and thank all of you out there for listening.